Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musing podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. And today we welcome a guest on our podcast from a company called Oncommune. Oncommune is a biotech company that specializes in blood tests and services that make use of the immune system. The early CDT blood tests can detect cancer in the earliest stages when the body's immune system is trying to fight it, whilst the company's understanding of the immune system means they're able to work closely with pharmaceutical companies to ensure treatments such as immunotherapy are as effective and as safe as possible. Now, the CEO, Adam Hill, is here to talk to us. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Mark. Good to speak to you.
Yep. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks. Very good.
Yep. Where is it you're calling us from today, Adam?
I'm at home in the Hampshire countryside, enjoying the warm weather. I think it's been 30 degrees, hasn't it? Maybe 42, stifling in my office, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's been a warm day.
Yeah, it's a bit muggy up here, but it's raining in Scotland, but that's just the norm, so we get used to it. It's not raining, we're concerned. But how's life in Hampshire then? I think obviously you're a few weeks ahead of Scotland with regards to the lockdown. Is life getting back to normal?
I think life in the country has been relatively serene throughout. People, of course, have been ensuring that they're no closer than 2 meters from anyone in the street. The queues in the supermarkets are orderly. And there's been less traffic on the roads, but over the last couple of weeks, three maybe, there has been an increase in activity. Everyone's busy, and I think looking forward to the opportunity to get back into a pub, go out for a nice meal, and importantly meet friends and family.
Yeah, definitely. All these things used to take for granted, 3 or 4 months ago. It's amazing what the lockdown has done. It's made people refocus and think about their lives and values, etc. So if there's any good to come out of it, it's definitely that. So what we would like to do, Adam, before we talk about the company, we'd like to delve into your background. And it's up to you how far you want to go back, where you were born, what kind of schooling did you have, etc., etc. Really, the floor's yours for the next 10-15 minutes to take us back to the young Adam.
I won't try and bore you with tales of daring do as a 7-year-old, but I had a bit of an eclectic upbringing. I was the son of a mother and a father who were in the British military, and so spent my time following them around the world until I think they realised my schooling had been disrupted sufficiently, and so with the help of Her Majesty's government sent me into a boarding school in the English countryside, and I learned how to be a farmer, ride horses, and generally be a tearaway. I can't really remember doing a huge amount of schooling, quite frankly, but I had a blissful life up until the age of 13, and then was sent to a sent to an altogether tougher, highly competitive and focused institution that reminded me about Pythagoras and calculus and Moa Masamat and the like, and put me through a series of examinations, of which I came out relatively well, and then went off to medical school. Having never been to London, I opted to go to one of the London medical schools, which, unbeknown to me, was actually merging with a university called Imperial College at the time. And so, having applied to St. Mary's Hospital, historic and well-known, I guess infamous maybe, for the discovery of penicillin, amongst other things, I found myself at an engineering university.
Sorry to interrupt, Adam, I can actually, that's quite bizarre you mentioned penicillin. So I was actually born in the village where Sir Alexander Fleming was born as well.
Is that right?
Yeah. So he was born in Darvel in Ayrshire, Scotland, and that's where I was born as well. In fact, I used to walk past his house every other week because it was out in the country. So there you go. There's a fact just to throw in. And sorry to take you off track, but...
Isn't that remarkable? Isn't that remarkable? I think they've still got his little laboratory where he left a Petri dish on the windowsill, and spores landed on the Petri dish, and he was able to identify penicillin from that random experiment just off Praed Street in Paddington in London.
Remarkable.
Anyway, that little medical school became part of a very large university, and in so doing, gave me the opportunity to learn a little bit about things outside of medicine, including engineering. And I ended up veering off course, doing an engineering degree and a PhD on the back of that before finishing off my medical qualification. But having been at university forever, I was poor, and one night on the Dodgems, at a Christmas party that my parents had dragged me along to, the last man standing was the old Surgeon General, who, when I bemoaned my fate, tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Well, you need to come and see me in my office tomorrow. We're going to have a chat about your future." And it was a chat that led me to doing 8 years in the British Army.
Right. Okay. Wow. So what, and you went to medical school, was that to, did you have a focus, because a lot of people go with an idea they want to specialise in something, become a GP or specialise in some area. What was your thought before you went to medical school?
I wanted to be a surgeon, for no better reason than I'd played the game Operation when I was a child. Thought that I was quite good. He realised it was nothing like that. It probably led me to find something else that I was good at as a child. Air models and building Lego bridges and trying to fix my bike, all were things that I enjoyed. And so I was captured. My imagination was captured by engineering, which is where I then headed.
Right, so the army wasn't medical then?
It was, but they quickly realised that I had an engineering qualification, and we were in the thick of fighting battles on two fronts in Iraq and Afghanistan, and there was a number of unanswered questions, challenges that we were seeing that had been described in the dim and distant past, Falklands most recently. That there really were no answers to still. And I, being a sort of a cocky young second lieutenant, stuck my hand up in a conference and suggested that I might be able to answer some of these questions, which in the break I again was collared by the same Surgeon General. Right, we have a job for you. And I was sent to set up a research effort at Imperial, actually, and in order not to skive off regimental duties, I was sent across the road to the Household Cavalry to perform my regimental duties there in the mornings and in the afternoon, back at Imperial in the lab, trying to work out why when things go bang, we don't always fare well.
Okay.
Okay. interesting. So did you actually get out in any field of activities, so to speak, Adam?
Well, I tried to avoid all of that. I think they realised that I was probably no good at looking after a weapon. I'd probably shoot someone, if not myself. So they stuck me on the back of a horse, which I was far more able to.
Okay.
Having been to that little prep school in the countryside many years before, and put me in a laboratory, which I was happy with.
Okay. And well, so what actually were you researching? Can you say or not?
No. That research effort still continues. I'm no longer involved in it. But we set up a centre called the Centre for Blast Injury Studies with some veteran funding, and we were interested in why tissues, and so our muscles, our skin, our fat, our vessels, why they respond in the way that they do respond.
Okay.
To strain rates, to being hit very hard by flying debris as a result of a bomb blast.
Okay.
And we were seeing weird and wonderful things over at Headley Court that couldn't be described, that couldn't be understood using our conventional approach to medicine. So, and so we needed to go back and rethink the basic processes that lead to some of these pathologies that we were having to deal with. And the research effort was intended to help with that understanding, as well as try to develop products that could mitigate against those injuries should they occur.
Okay. I guess did you see a lot of, was it pretty gruesome at times or not really?
A lot of the injuries were. I mean, spent time at Headley and supporting the work there by running a clinic, and the injuries that we saw were certainly life changing. But in many cases, the rehabilitation that these men and women were afforded enabled them to have a second life.
It
was quite remarkable. I felt that we could use our noggin and maybe do a little better with the way in which some of these injuries were being managed, or indeed some of these injuries occurred.
So you were looking at real cases then? You weren't simulating anything, they were all real?
We looked at real cases. We also simulated things in the lab. So one of the efforts that we're involved in is trying to simulate a bomb blast in the middle of South Kensington surrounded by embassies. And you might imagine that when simulating a bomb blast, the most effective way of doing that is to build a bomb.
Yeah.
but that wasn't clearly not allowed. So we devised a setup that would fire a 40 kilo plate up into the air up to 25 meters per second, 100 miles an hour, and back down again in a displacement of 20 centimeters. So this thing really did act as if it was a bomb going off. And the sound was quite remarkable. But in so doing, we were able to measure the effects of this strain rate of a bomb blast upon those tissues that I described earlier.
Right. Wow. Okay. That sounds fantastic.
Yes, sir. So 8 years you spent in the army, Adam. So what happened to make you want to leave? Was it just a change of direction, or did you've done enough for, what was the trigger to leave the army?
I think with all of these things, you've got what you came for, and they've probably taken their pound of flesh, and you're about quits, and it's time to move on. But I think more importantly, I'd failed a couple of times to develop some of the insight that we'd developed through that process into real products that could be used in the field by my colleagues. At the time, and the only reason we were failing on a number of occasions is because we knew nothing about commercialization. We knew nothing about making money. We're all academics and clinicians, and so I went to business school, and I went to business school really to learn that black art and try and understand how to better get those developments into the hands of people that can use them. That was my step into industry about a decade ago or so now.
All right, okay. And what was your sort of first year business school for a couple of years? Was that the...
Yeah, I did it in parallel to work at time, which I think was a good choice, because I learned far more from actually rolling my sleeves up and getting my hands dirty than sat in lectures, excellent education as it was. And that first job that really gave me an insight into the way that business is transacted was doing two things, really. I went to a management consultancy, and in the first part of my week, I was involved in writing and delivering the UK's life science strategy. The second part of my week, I was involved in working on challenging problems for large corporates that would engage a product development consultancy. So an excellent education for my first role in industry, which then led on to actually going and working for one of my clients in Sweden. My first job as a chief medical officer.
When did Onkimmune come about?
So I completed that role as a chief medical officer. I was poached by a fast car company called McLaren, and over a period of 3 years, I was increasingly involved in developing sensors and analyzing the data from those sensors, which I started to appreciate was very much what we needed to do in the diagnostics industry. And so when looking for a way back into healthcare, having strayed into the engineering field for a little longer than I had anticipated, it was a diagnostic company that I was keen to work for. And Onkimmune was an excellent opportunity that came along at the right time.
Right. Okay. And what was your role in that when you went to join them?
So, having been chief medical officer twice in two companies, I joined as the chief medical officer, but with a remit to write the forward strategy, the 3-year forward strategy, which we're now delivering.
Okay.
And that played very nicely into the skill sets that I developed. Being to business school, and then having been responsible, albeit wearing the CMO role, for strategy, innovation, business development, medical affairs, variably across a number of organizations, I was able to bring that to bear at Onkimmune. Okay. My first 4 months in the organization was writing that 3-year forward strategy.
I see. And then when was these moved to the CEO role?
Well, I think that was very much always on the cards.
Yeah.
Of course, the strategy needed to be endorsed by the board of directors and by shareholders, and of course, I needed a mandate to deliver it. But once they were comfortable with the strategy, after a little bit of optimization, I was given that mandate, and with it, I stepped up into the CEO role. I took over the founding chief executive of the organization, who had been with the company for 17 years since its since its outset. Big shoes to step into, but got straight on with delivering that strategy we've touched on.
Okay, I didn't know the company was that old. That so it's been going quite a long time then.
It has spun out of Nottingham University, out of a group run by a man called Professor John Robertson, who's a breast surgeon but sometime immunologist. And John had identified these circulating proteins in the blood of women with metastatic breast cancer, and the hypothesis that he formed was that those proteins were of our immune system. They acted as the policemen for normal cells that divide on a daily basis and sometimes don't divide properly and need to be squashed before cancer takes hold. But when the immune proteins that he identified become dysfunctional, they unfortunately allow cancer to form. And so he thought that these proteins might give us a window in on the very earliest stages of cancer development, because from first principles, the biology suggests that might be the case. And I think over time, we've demonstrated that is likely to be the case.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in there. I'm actually looking at your presentation at the moment, and I didn't actually realise that, you know, cancer is actually 1 in 6 deaths worldwide is related to cancer.
Yeah, I was surprised at that.
The cases are actually on the increase as well, quite dramatically. What's the reasoning behind that, Adam?
Well, I think there's a few reasons. First, we're better at diagnosing it than we've ever been, despite the fact we've got a long, long way to go. We pick it up often before people die. Even if we're picking it up late, we do pick it up. So the harder you look, the more of the disease you'll find. The second reason, though, and I think this is probably more obvious, is that our lifestyle has changed dramatically in only a few decades. And as a result, whether it be smoking or eating the wrong foodstuffs, obesity, diabetes, the environments in which we live, 70% of the world's population now living in built-up environments, cities, metropolises, has led to external factors that have been linked to cancer being more prevalent. Those two reasons, the fact that we look harder and we look with better tools, and that we live in environments that predispose us to cancer more so than maybe in the past, has led to the numbers that we're now seeing. And in fact, those numbers will only continue to grow.
I mean, everyone knows someone who's been affected by cancer, don't they? It's a terrible thing.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, I mean, it might be 1 in 6 that die from the disease, but, you know, 1 in 3 of us will get it at some point in our lifetime in this country. The hope, of course, is that we get it picked up very early, because one thing that's clear in the majority of cancers is the earlier you pick up the disease, the better your chance of surviving the disease. In lung cancer, for example, picking up at stage 1, which is the earliest form of the disease, it hasn't metastasized, it's localized disease at that time, you're probably asymptomatic. You don't have any cough or malaise, any reason to be seeing your GP, but you do have cancer. Actually, in that group, your chance of surviving 5 years is about 60 to 70%. However, if you're picked up at stage 4, the latest form of the disease, your chance of surviving 5 years is maybe as little as 6%. So we have a cure for cancer, and that's called early detection.
So I was going to ask, so Oncoimmune, it's not a treatment for cancer. It's the early detection, which, if I understand correctly, is based upon the proteins that the cancer produces when it's in the body, triggers like an immune response that you can then detect through a simple blood test.
That's exactly it. So we are not measuring the cancer directly itself, like every other cancer diagnostic out there.
Yeah,
we're measuring a proxy of that cancer. It's the body's own response to the disease. Now you may ask, well, why is no one else doing this? And again, I think two good reasons. The first, that we've laid down a fairly extensive patent estate and become known as the experts in the use of autoantibodies, these proteins that your body produces against itself, against its cancer cells, over the last 20 years. But more importantly, the oncology community really has only started to awake to the idea that the immune system has a role in cancer at all over the last 12, 15 years. So it's relatively new. despite the fact it's been around for a while, much of the science that now is really catalyzing this company is relatively new.
Yeah, we've heard a lot, haven't we, about immunotherapy and like CAR T cells being you know quite a breakthrough perhaps in cancer treatment. But I get what you're saying. It's the fact that from day one that someone develops cancer, just like someone would develop, you know, an immune response from a simple cut, the body is already responding to that, and you're looking for that sign immediately before any physical signs ever would appear under what we would today, presumably, you know, that's how we would diagnose cancer today, when someone complains of a lump or, you know, a cough or what have you. So, I mean, what stage are you at in this process then? I mean, it's probably too early to be saying, yeah, we've got a cure for cancer. But I did note that Joe Biden promised to cure cancer if he got elected. What is your outlook on that? And where is the sort of the company or the research at this stage?
Well, look, one of the challenges of detecting cancer early has been that the ways in which we've gone about detecting it are akin to looking for a needle in a haystack.
Mm-hmm.
Look at one or two or 10 or 100 cells that are now cancerous in the billions of cells in your body. The proxy approach that we use allows us to, in fact, look for the haystacks in a field. It's an amplification which allows us to immediately get in there and understand whether you've got cancer or not at a very, very early stage, the first cluster of cells. And so this different approach, this different lens on the cancer problem does allow us to move the needle in increasing survival from a diagnosis of the disease. Now, that increase might be fairly significant. In one study, the UK CTOC study, we saw that using our product, we were able to pick up the disease 4 years ahead of standard of care, which in that case was the NHS.
Right.
And 3 years is a meaningful window in which to pick up earlier disease and treat it appropriately.
Mm. And what cancers can you test for?
Well, we've come out of the trap in 2012 and focused on lung cancer. For no better reason than it's the largest unmet need today, and it was then. In 2018, we launched the liver test. For no better reason than it's a very significant unmet need in patients with a viral hepatitis, and that group of patients is growing, particularly in Asian populations. But importantly, this platform, this approach, this use of the immune proxy to detect the disease early is applicable across all solid tumors. And so we have a prostate, ovarian, and breast panel, which is, you know, only a small handful of months away from market.
Right. And is the research then presumably people who have that cancer that you're researching into, are you then looking what antibodies they have or what proteins they have, and then forming like a map or something that you can gather to then develop the test?
That's exactly it.
Okay.
So we all have a different immune signature. And that's in no small part a function of our genetics, who we are, our code that has given us, you know, blonde hair and blue eyes or black skin. It's very much a part of us. But more importantly, it's also a function of our history, what we've been exposed to, whether we're brought up on a farmyard or in a city, whether we were exposed to the common cold, influenza or coronavirus or not, and equally whether we've been exposed to cancer.
Right. Okay.
So that unique immune signature can be difficult to access and use and harness when you're developing a diagnostic. But what we do is we create a very large map of those immune signatures, and we try and find common elements.
Yeah.
Those immune signatures, and those common elements, if common enough, allow us to form a diagnostic panel.
Yeah.
And that diagnostic panel then is tested in a population to see how it performs.
Yeah.
And if it's the criteria, if it meets a threshold for performance, we know we've got a product.
Yeah.
All right. So rolling forward, say 5 or 10 years, Adam, you guys have nailed the mapping, and you know you've got your database or our protein library. How would you take this to the mass population? You know, how, because obviously you want to detect, you know, cancer, as you guys say, 3 or 4 years earlier in the NHS. How would it get out to the masses? How would it work?
Well, a lung cancer panel, early CDT lung, is a great example here. Early CDT lung has got two uses. It can either be used, and it was intended to be used, in patients that have turned up at their GP with a cough and have been sent for an x-ray. And on that x-ray, there is a small white dot. The dot is called a nodule. Now, the majority of patients with nodules don't have cancer, but 4 to 40% of patients with nodules on an x-ray do have cancer. So the question is, how do you determine who has cancer and who doesn't from this dot on an x-ray? Mm-hmm. Well, next step is a biopsy, sticking a needle through someone's chest wall to try and hit a dot, a white dot on an x-ray that maybe is 5 millimeters in diameter, that of course is moving because you're breathing. Now that's challenging. Mm. It's not only challenging technically, but it can often lead to false diagnoses or side effects. It can lead to a collapsed lung. So the use of a different diagnostic tool, such as our blood test, can be interposed here between that x-ray and the biopsy to really give you confidence that these are the people you should be biopsying, and that those people over there, maybe you continue just to keep an eye on rather than send for a biopsy. So that was the first use of the test. The second came out of a very large study, in fact, the largest study of a blood test for cancer detection in the world. Our study, run up in Scotland, it was called ECLS ECHOS, colloquially. And that study recruited 12,210 people that didn't recognize themselves as patients, but were smokers. Smokers and over the age of 50, many of whom came from the tenement blocks of Glasgow, deprived often, and some of whom hadn't even never met their primary care physician. And the test that they were asked to come and take, our test, pushed them either into an x-ray follow-up, CT scan follow-up over a 2-year period, or it pushed them into GP follow-up. And what we saw from using tests in that environment, not the nodule environment, but what we would call the screening environment, is we saw a 36% reduction in those stage 3s and 4s that have the worst outcomes of the disease. Remember, this is the largest study of its kind. It took 7 years. It's at least 2 years worth of follow-up on 12,210 patients, and that data presented on the president's podium at the biggest lung cancer conference in the world last September in Barcelona, and is due to be published in a peer-reviewed publication, as all of these scientific studies need to be in the coming weeks.
Is the test ready now then, Adam?
We sold 160,000 of them, primarily in the US, across Europe and into Asia. And so it's very much ready now. It's a test that can be ordered privately in the UK, and there are ongoing conversations with the NHS about adopting that test.
Right. It strikes me as odd that I haven't heard about this because it does sound pretty significant to me in cancer treatment, and you often see the headlines pop up when there is a breakthrough. So I just wonder why, or maybe I've missed it, why there's perhaps not the hype, but the headline around this.
I think there have been lots of headlines in some of the big newspapers, broadsheet and tabloid alike.
Okay.
There have been headlines in peer-reviewed medical publications over the years, and that the density of these publications is increasing year upon year.
Okay.
You must remember that it takes many years to not only develop the science, but then prove that the science has got some medical applicability.
Yeah, of course.
And we launched this test in 2012. We've sold 160,000 of those. But in the last 8 years, we've also been building the evidence to support the sale of many more.
Yep. And you guys also manufacture these tests in-house as well?
In-house and through supply partners. And so we've not entirely bought the supply chain in-house, but in order to ensure constant supply, we have a number of trusted partners that also supply us, and they're all based in the UK.
Okay.
Yeah. Is there any plans to sort of license out to third-party manufacturers or clients?
Kenny, we have a number of relationships. We sell into 22 countries now. The majority of those are indirect sales through distributors. But we have three key relationships. The first is in the US. Biodesix, a US domiciled lung cancer focused diagnostic company, privately held, but excellent at what they do, has the exclusive rights to market and commercialize early CDT lung for nodules in the US. They have the ability also to exercise an option by the end of this year to extend those rights to screening using the same product. So they are very much in charge of driving uptake in the US, one of our major markets. The other major market that we have is China. And in China, we have, again, an exclusive partner who has the rights to market and commercialize the early CDT products in the People's Republic of China, Hong Kong, and Macau. But of course, before they're able to do that, they need to go through the NMPA, the regulatory authority. And they are in the middle of doing that with lung and liver as we speak. The third relationship that we have that's worthy of note for your listeners is with R-Pharm, the largest drug distributor in Russia, who are in the process of establishing a screening program in Moscow using our product. All of those deals have been done over the last 18 months to support the uptake of our products.
Okay. And with your products, do they have to go through clinical trials, or I guess it's not a treatment as such, so I don't know if it applies. Is it more like the fact that it's out there now and it's being tested in the field? Is that sort of how you build up the proof, if you like, of its credibility?
So with diagnostics, as long as you've undertaken in-house both the technical and commercial validation of the test, you can launch it.
Okay.
Challenge being that very few people are going to buy it unless you develop the evidence to support its sale. And so you then spend time and money as sales start to take off, you spend time and money building the evidence to support the performance of the test in the market. People have often referred to specificity and sensitivity, the two percentages that we use to describe the performance of the diagnostic. We also build evidence around the harm done by the diagnostic, or in fact the lack of harm in this case done by the use of a diagnostic. Of course, changing a clinician's decision can inadvertently lead to harm somewhere else in the pathway, and you need to demonstrate that that isn't the case with your diagnostic. And then the final bit of evidence, of course, is around the costs to the system, the health economics. So those three bits of evidence need building in order to support the adoption of products. And in our case, that evidence has been built. It's already been submitted to NICE, and NICE in March this year gave us a very, very positive MedTech innovation briefing on the use of the product in nodules.
Okay.
So it's quite advanced. In fact, as a test, a blood test for cancer, it is most advanced in lung cancer in terms of the evidence, the level of evidence that has been generated.
So what is next then for the company? What's the ongoing work that you're doing? And what is next sort of in the pipeline going forward?
So we set out a three-year forward strategy about 20 months ago. We've just come to the end of our first full year of trading in that strategy. And you know, I was delighted to be able to tell our shareholders at the beginning of June that it's the first year this company's met market expectation. And that's because we have an excellent pipeline of commercial activities delivering against that strategy. The strategy said three things. It said, we're going to do more products that we've done in the past. We were known for lung cancer. We launched liver cancer in the strategy. Ovarian, breast and prostate coming down the pipeline.
Okay.
The second thing it said was that there are opportunities for our proprietary technology after a cancer has been diagnosed in helping patients and doctors understand which therapy is most likely to work in their cancer. Now, this is important because, of course, health systems spend 4-5% of their budget on diagnosing cancer and 95% of their budget on treating it.
Mm-hmm.
So we followed the money with the strategy and said, look, I mean, this technology has not just relevance in detecting the disease, but also supporting physicians in making the right decisions for the right patients with the right drugs. And in that regard, we have done three big deals in the last 3 months. Mm-hmm. The one that's hit the headlines is the deal that we've done with Roche. In fact, they've only recently re-upped on that deal. And so we have now a relationship with them in supporting their work in immuno-oncology. But there are two other biotech and pharmaceutical companies that we are also working with on the service side of our business. And then the final leg to our stool was to say, look, we're a small company. We quite like being a small company because it allows us to be agile, feet to foot, turn on sixpence. But recognize that we can't unlock the latent potential of this platform without holding hands with others. And so partnering is absolutely key. Being a good partner is absolutely key to our strategy. And you will start to see more brands that we're able to point to as partners of this technology over Q1 and Q2.
Okay. I'm actually there's one thing that's caught my eye in your presentation, Adam. I think it's a sort of roadmap near the end. You're actually sort of preparations are underway for a sort of evaluation of 200,000 people to be tested with the your early CDT technology. That's quite that's 200,000 people is a lot of people.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's massive. We're
tempted to do this. But whilst we have the highest level of evidence for this product's use in detecting cancer through a blood test, there is one more step that we can take. No one's gone there before, and no one's gone there for, Kenny, the very reason that you've identified, which is that the numbers are huge. But we think there's a way of doing it, and we think there's a way of undertaking this evaluation, not a study, because we know the test works in this patient population, but an evaluation to see what the impact upon a system of care on the NHS would be if we did this. And so we're working very hard to formulate that study design and have a number of experts look at it, comment upon it, and validate it. Because of course, if we enter into this this process, there's no turning back.
And I take it these people away from multiple countries across the world, different demographics, etc.
I think we whilst the study is likely to be a platform study, which means that we can bolt on other regions, both within the UK and outside of the UK. We are fiercely a UK first company, And whilst we have made great strides elsewhere, the US, China, Russia, to Europe, and other parts of Asia Pacific, we are yet to have an impact on the UK. And so we see this as an opportunity to do that.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's fascinating talking about this. The only thing I would, I guess, finish with is focusing on perhaps the London listing. How long have you been actually listed on the stock exchange?
So early 2016, we were listed on AIM. And over that time, there has been some significant changes to our register, not least when I came in and put in place the forward strategy and started to deliver a turnaround, moving a company from being research first to commercialization first.
Okay.
And now that's really starting to pay dividends. Shareholder, I think, is being rewarded for the support that they've given us.
Okay. Yeah, the share price is definitely, you know, obviously as more stocks did, they had a wee blip during COVID, but it's reacted very well. I mean, it looks as if it's up three times since the peak of the COVID crisis. So it's about 90 million market cap, I think, the company currently
It's about that now. And Kenny, yeah. I think, you know, we're one of the few diagnostic companies to steer clear of doing anything in COVID. We're absolutely here to support our cancer patients, because irrespective of whether we've got a pandemic or not, cancer still need detecting and treating. So what I hope you're seeing is alpha rather than the beta effect of the market. Our strategy is delivering. People are recognizing that.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a few companies have jumped on the COVID bandwagon. So it's good to see that you're sticking to your core strategy and focusing on these cancer treatments. It's definitely creating shareholder value. So I'll be doing a bit of digging. It's certainly, we've never had a pharma a company on at all. So it's good to sort of diversify away from our sort of usual sort of mining, sort of crypto and sort of tech. So yeah, it's been great having you on, and we'd like to have you on again if you can. You can spare the time. We can maybe speak to you in sort of 3 or 4 months and see where the company is at and how you're getting on with that mammoth evaluation project of 200,000 people. It must be quite a task to manage that database. It'd be interesting to see how you do it in the future. But no, I appreciate your time, and don't know, Mark, have you got anything to add?
No. The only thing I would maybe throw on you, Adam, is occasionally we ask when we have a guest that's a CEO of a listed company to perhaps do like a 60-second pitch, sort of directed at potential private investors or current shareholders, as you know, 60 seconds of why the company is a good investment. So I know I've just thrown it on you, and you could say no, but would you like to have a go?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, in that case, what I'll do is I'll start my stopwatch in 60 seconds. Maybe you want to keep an eye on the nearest second hand in your area. And when we get to sort of about 50 seconds, I will just sort of give you a 10-second warning that your time is running out. But I'll count you down in 3, 2, 1. Take it away.
Thanks, Mark. So Oncommune is a company that listed in 2016, and we are the experts in profiling the immune response to cancer. And over that time, we have launched both products and our Immune Insight service. Our products include the lung test, for which we're probably best known, our liver test, and soon to be launched prostate, ovarian, and breast tests. They detect cancer earlier than any other diagnostic on the market, with good evidence to support that. The service business, our Immune Insights business, works hand in hand with pharmaceutical companies to understand who is going to respond positively to immune drugs for cancer and who is going to go on to get immune-related adverse events. Plenty of news flow over the last 3 months and lots more to look forward to in Q1 and Q2 of this financial year.
Perfect. There we go. Spot on. Well done.
Yeah, it was very good. Very good. Put in the spot. Sometimes that's the best. If you've got a chance to think about it, it doesn't quite come out the same. If you're put in the spot, it's sometimes better. But there we go. Yep, delighted you came on. And as I said earlier, Adam, we would like to get you back on if you can spare the time. And
yeah, I'd be more than happy to. That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, perfect.
Well, thank you very much, Adam, for your time. Thank you.
No, real pleasure. Thanks a lot, guys.
Cheers.
Bye.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.